Today we're gonna finish the discussion related to measurements and very likely start a new topic. But before leaving these discussions, I really want to talk a little bit more in depth about the dilation theorems, I guess, and then show you a little presentation about how things get worse when you involve relativity, right? Because most of the discussions that we have here feel very separated from fundamental theories fundamental quantum theories, right? Because for that you need at least to the level that we work today, we need relativity for that. So maybe a couple of considerations in QFT as well related to that. But before we begin, a little summary of the measurement problem. One of the issues around the measurement problem and the quantum to classical transition, right? So the measurement problem, as you know, is that, well, imagine that you're measuring some state of a system, a two-dimensional system or a system like that, and the outcome of the measurement that you're looking at is the observable for which these are eigenstates, and you know how the outcome would be either a 1 or a 0. That's what it is. Has to be a 1 or a 0, right? Now, the problem is that we begin with something like this, if that's the state, and then there is some process, whatever it is, that in the end returns just a number out of that. And not only that, it updates the state, and the state after the update has to be the eigenstate corresponding to that number that you obtained. And that's complicated, right? Because fundamental description, if we say, well, everything is quantum in the world, or quantum theory should describe at least at this level of energy that we live in, should describe everything, the operation of going from that to a number, to one definite state, one definite outcome, oh, this is one definite state anyways, one definite outcome for an experiment is tricky. I mean, as you know by now, because you've seen it, it's not enough in general to consider that the physical evolution comes like doing a projection. That's not the case, right? That would not be able to describe unitary evolution in general. So the problem that we have is where exactly in the chain that leads to from that state to an experimentalist writing down or a computer showing you the number 0 or the number 1, where exactly have we lost this notion of unitary evolution and coupling to the environment? What exactly it is, if anything, beyond quantum mechanics? You see what I mean? Because the dynamics in quantum mechanics can't really explain the generality of cases where you go from a probability distribution like that in the possible outcomes to one definite state. What happens? Make sense? That's the issue, fundamentally. What is it? What is it that does it? What part of quantum mechanics? What is the microscopics? If you tell somebody, oh, no, it's just a projection, that somebody, and rightfully so, would ask, oh, what do you mean microscopically? What is that projection? What's going on when you measure, right? What do the atoms there do? What do you mean a projector? A projector is not a microscopic result. It's an effective description. Make sense? Now, we could quickly get into, like, it depends. So, for example, if you, maybe, I mean, I'm going to talk on behalf of somebody else who's not here. And so my apologies if I misrepresent Leslie Valentine, because I'm going to talk about him. There are ways in which people can explain this kind of thing, saying, well, that state, if you represent it as a 2x2 matrix, it's something like this, no? That's a density matrix associated with that state. Agreed? Everybody? And then you say, well, right. What happens? So typically, if I'm going to, so this is one way of talking about it. Typically, if I'm going to measure in this basis, right? Well, the apparatus that I connect to do that measurement, right? After interaction with the environment as well, well, the environment is going to introduce the coherence in the privileged basis that I'm measuring. What does that mean? Well, that means that there's going to be some dynamical process that's going to kill these two elements, right? In the basis that you're measuring. So these two elements can be explained phenomenologically. If I give you a master equation, if I give you an open quantum system description, dynamical description of what happens when information from that state leaks to the environment, there are mechanisms that are pretty physically reasonable that explain this by killing dynamically these two elements, right? So yeah, the interaction with the apparatus and the environment kill the non-diagonal elements. So you go from a superposition like this to a state like that, no? Agreed? Everybody? So that's the coherent mechanism explanation of what's going on when you measure it, like the microscopics. What's happening is the coherence happening in the bases that you're measuring, right? Well, then there's an issue, right? Because you still don't have what you want. I still have a probability. Mine is a single system, right? I still have a probability distribution. That doesn't tell me the result is zero or one. Some experimentalists obtain a zero or one. You have gone from a quantum superposition, if you want, to a classical probability distribution, but still it's a single system, right? So what is the exact mechanism on a single system? I mean, if we think about it in the very safe terms that I introduced, like, well, this is just the ignorance about the measurement. No, but the experimentalist makes a measurement. What is the microscopical mechanism on a single particle that does that? So the coherence alone does not solve the problem of how you go from a probability distribution, right, to a single value. What happened? Keep in mind, after the measurement, the state would be an eigenstate of these two. And that's the only compatible outcome after the measurement, if you know exactly what the result is. Make sense? Within the interpretations of quantum mechanics, there's one that should be loved a little bit more, but it's not. Or at least that's the impression that I get. In fact, Leslie Valentine used to, back in the day, before my time here in Waterloo, used to come here, perimeter, and explain things and give a talk about interpretations of quantum mechanics. And poor people get disturbed by the Valentine interpretation of quantum mechanics. There are two interpretations of quantum mechanics that feel like complete opposite, but not to me. And one of them is very well liked. And then there's the Valentine interpretation that doesn't really get the love that it needs, even though it's very self-consistent, very interesting. So the one that's very well liked, above all among high-energy physicists, is the many-worlds interpretation, right? You will hear reference to it everywhere, right? And that's an interesting one. And we can talk about both and see which one is more deranged. And then we talk about, I mean, I like both, huh? Don't get me wrong. Is this not bad-mouthing them? But the number of derangement that you need, or the amount of derangement that you need in one and the other. So the Valentine interpretation, so in the many worlds interpretation, it's very interesting, right? Very summarized. Again, not going to get into the details. They would tell you, well, we should understand this in terms of more like the path integral formulation of quantum mechanics. And in that path integral formulation of quantum mechanics, every element in this superposition is represented in a way, things that do happen, all of them have existence or a notion of physical reality, right? And you know, when you measure every time that you get the outcome of a probabilistic event, well, there's a branching of universes, if you want, and you get that in some universes, half of them in this case would be zero, half of them would be one, and we just observing the one that is one. Very rough summary. I don't know, anybody here a fan of the many world interpretation? I would not believe nobody. Nobody? But then you're not going to like holography and things like that. They use that a lot to interpret things. Nobody, huh? What's your favorite? Okay, this is a poll. What's your favorite interpretation of quantum mechanics when it regards to measurements? Is the answer none? You don't have one? Or you just shut up and compute? Well, I think it's going to be important, actually, to get into these things if we want to get a fundamental. You know how long have we been trying to get a description that is consistent for gravity and everything else? Huh? Most of the time quantum, but not always, because we believe that quantum is better than classical descriptions for reasons, right? You know how long have we been trying as a species? You know that? Anybody? Rough estimate?
100 years.
More than 100 now, but yeah, 100 years. Einstein himself started this. More than 100 years now, huh? You know how much success we've had? I mean, then it's opinable, right? In between none at all and a tiny amount. Agreed? We don't have a consistent description for gravity together with everything else. In fact, our best description for gravity, which is that we have and has been tested experimentally, which is general relativity, already tells you that doesn't work, no? General relativity predicts its own demise, predicts things that are not possible, let's say, in a physical theory, admissible. And general relativity says, yeah, yeah, sure, sure, apply me with care, right? Only to the regimes where I work. And yet nobody has found a case yet where general relativity doesn't seem to explain everything. Yeah, question.
Yes, so like, okay, could you please recap, so we did like this lecture and particularly in this discussion. So you were saying that like if I couple my system to environment, and if I, so we discussed something like this the last lecture, right? So we can imagine this process as like unitary evolution in this enlarged space. But you said that we can only like kill coherence, but like we still have probability.
We'll get there. So I'm going to mention how it relates to things that we've seen at the very end. What I'm telling you is that one of the mechanisms, right, that you can explain dynamically is the coherence. There's a way to explain it. With open quantum systems, you can explain the coherence, no problem. So you have that. So going from a superposition to a classical probability distribution, we know how to do microscopically in terms of measurements. That is something that people can explain. That's all that I was saying. But still we have the problem that how do you go from the classical probability distribution to the number that you get? Yeah.
Is that even a quantum question? It sounds like a classical question.
It is a quantum question in the sense that we're talking about quantum systems, all right? Classically, it's very easy to answer. Classically is that, well, the moment that I have this, it's just, it has a definite value, and I know what the definite value is, right? I don't know what the definite value, I just look. In here, you're saying that the coherence picks a value, so the system already has a value, you just don't know it, but you can interpret it like that. But still, you're not telling me the microscopics. How do you know from a theory that doesn't have realism, or local realism, to one that does? How? What? Dynamically, what happened? Anyway, so what I was saying is that we still don't understand well. We've been failing for more than 100 years, for a century now, trying to do quantum gravity. Quantum gravity that is as successful as quantum theories for everything else and relativity for gravity. Maybe it's because we don't understand some things about some aspects about quantum theory, right? I would say maybe understanding these things are important, is important. Anyway, point being that you have the issue, right? Then you get Leslie Ballantyne. Ballantyne would tell you, again, my apologies to Ballantyne if I misrepresent. But Ballantyne needs some love. People don't like, on average, people, above all, people working in quantum gravity and all those things don't like this kind of interpretation, but let's talk about it. Ballantyne tells you, okay, so in physics, Ballantyne's very informational, by the way. In physics, in order to make a discovery, would you claim, if you see a single shot experiment, that you've discovered something? No, right? It's not just physics, we're talking science. You need repeatability. You need to be able to consistently and in a controlled manner be able to repeat an outcome given an input, no? You need statistics. Even in particle physics, you don't claim that you've discovered anything until you have like something like 5 sigma or 6 sigma uncertainty event, right? Meaning that, I repeat it many times statistically and it's not a fluke. It's really a consistent pattern that will repeat statistically. Make sense? So Leslie Ballantyne would tell you, well, maybe, and again, I'm stretching it, but maybe single shot experiments are not elements of physical reality. Maybe to claim that something is physical, you need to do a ton of experiments and gather statistics. Maybe probability distributions are the elements of physical reality. Maybe single-shot experiments are an illusion. You're looking at an incomplete thing, and you need to look at the collective in order to claim something about physical reality. That's called the ensemble interpretation of quantum mechanics. There's just ensembles. There's no such thing as single unique events. At least they're not scientific, or they're not part of your theory. Well, in that sense, if you're like Ballantyne, you're done at that step. Agreed? Because that step tells you, well, you have a class, the moment you have a classical probability distribution, then you know what it is. You're describing a lot of experiments made with this, in which you get the coherence and then the classical probability distribution. You're not explaining what happens in a single experiment because you don't have to. It's not an element of physical reality. Trying to, but what's happening in the individual experiment? But I can't shoot a single electron And that was late, and I said, no, you see nothing. If it's a single electron, you would not be able to tell if there's interference just with one. You need to send many. No, but not at the same time. I don't care, still many. It's an ensemble. Make sense? Every time that we measure something and declare it measured, in a way, we need to do an ensemble. So Valentine would say, yeah, the problem is solved here. There's no need to explain how you go to here to a single event, because that's not even physical. Make sense? The Valentine interpretation? People don't like that. Or many people don't like that. Why? Well, because you say, well, but single shot experiments do exist. People, you know, is it really not true that I can't do a single experiment and it's an illusion? Is this not really a physical thing? Does that make sense? How many people like that interpretation here? I like it. It's consistent. Am I a subscriber? No, I'm not a subscriber of the interpretation. I'm not a subscriber of any. Nobody liked many worlds here? That is new this year. You do? Okay. I like many worlds as well. Many worlds is cool. Many worlds is compatible with many things that are nice to be compatible with. Both are cool. Many worlds get a lot more love than Valentine's interpretation. Which one do you think is more deranged? That there's no such thing as single shot experiments? Is there an illusion? Or that there are infinitely many universes depending on the possible outcomes of all experiments? Which one do you like better? How many people like the first one better? Yeah.
Many worlds, and this one is sort of like kind of like two sides of the same coin. No, it's kind of like two sides of the ergodic hypothesis, right? This one's sort of like the average in time, and many worlds is like the average in all the possible ones.
It's not an average. Many worlds goes to explain the single experiment. Many worlds tell you, well, when you measure one, you are in that path in particular. Many worlds does talk about single shot experiments. It's like you're in the right universe that happened.
I see what you mean.
Valentine tells you it's a futile attempt to try to explain a single shot experiment, so there's not. Both are self-consistent. Huh? They're both beautiful ways of looking at the problem. They're both deranged in their own ways. Makes sense? Again, maybe that's something to leave for a more foundational course to discuss, because we are not going to choose here. We don't have really a better way to do things, right? I'm like, you know the painting that the academia, where you have Plato and Socrates, and you get the world of ideas, and no. I'm going to be here. I'm going to talk about things that are more practical, because it's a quantum information course. I'm going to be an operationalist, okay? Meaning that, well, I don't care today about thinking about elevated things that are probably just a product of our minds, trying to cope with what's going on. Let's see two things that we can do. And then we go back to the dilation theorems. Any questions so far about this? It's good that you know about these things. Huh? I think it's important to, above all, PSI, no? You should worry about these things. Yeah.
I'm curious because when you asked about the many worlds interpretation, you said that, oh, then you probably don't like holography, but I fail to see the connection between the two.
Oh, no, it's just a correlation. It's not a need, an implication, or assumption. It's a correlation. If you talk with the fathers of the field, they would be many worlders in a way. Like you talk with Leo Susskind, talk with Maldacena and these people, right? So, but again, no, it's just a correlation, not a causation here. Makes sense? It's just that I found that people who are more into high energy physics and holography are more into many worlds. Correlation, not causation. Yeah. Makes sense? If you go to Oxford, the philosophy of physics department in Oxford is big on many worlds. Big. And that's because they're big on to more high energy physics as well. So in the philosophy realm, if you want, there's a lot of correlation between these two things as well. And that's where I was going. Anyway, so we go to measurements, the dilation theorems. And the dilation theorems tell you, all right, cool, you see, I solved one problem. One problem, the classic problem with this is like, well, I have a measurement apparatus, right? And the measurement apparatus carries out a projective measurement, quote unquote, and then it gives you the value, right? But then we say, well, but the measurement apparatus is not quite physical. Because you're saying that the measurement apparatus is not ruled by quantum mechanics. You showed it. In general, the action of coupling a system to an environment and a measurement apparatus, that all of them are quantum and evolving in time and not looking and carrying a measurement on the apparatus, that will not be a projective measurement on the system. So you are privileging a category of things that are called measurement apparatus with no reason to privilege it that are outside of quantum mechanics. They can do projective measurements dynamically. Now that problem is solved by Nyman's dilation theorem, because we know that, well, no, the measurement apparatus can also be quantum. And in fact, you can get this result with a quantum measurement apparatus. I couple it to the system, and then I do a projective measurement only on the apparatus, okay? And that apparatus gives me a value after the projective measurement. I'm not projecting onto the system. I have a POVM on the system. Sometimes it will coincide that that POVM is a projective one, if your system is simple enough, if you're careful enough, if you choose well, but not always. Make sense? So I can do this. Now, the problem that we have there is that we've moved the issue of projective measurements one level up. Now it's not the apparatus that is magical and it's outside of quantum mechanics and I can do projective measurements on it. Not the apparatus anymore. It's whatever measures the apparatus. See what I mean? The apparatus is quantum, the environment is quantum, the system is quantum, but then somebody does a PVM on the apparatus. This is what you did in your tutorial, right? So the problem here is like, well, how do you measure the, how have you solved the problem? Because you still have to do a PVM that you said is kind of magical if you can only do PVMs, right? Well, two answers to that. Well, maybe I'm going to limit myself. I'm going to definitely distinguish between two categories of quantum systems that are not measurement apparatuses and quantum systems that are measurement apparatuses. They're quantum though, but the seconds are the second class are the class of systems for which PVMs are really a good description of what's going on. So that's an operationalist view, meaning that, well, I don't care about the microscopics of measurement the apparatus. I assume that the measurement apparatus I can actually measure with a PVM. If you're happy with that, you're done. You can say, well, in the lab, we do these kinds of things, right? We have measurement apparatuses that really give you a determined answer, right? Like I can measure if an atom is in at a level, for example, I have a two-level atom, right? And I want to see in which one of the levels the atom is. Well, you shine a laser that enables a transition to a third level of only one of the two, not the other. So if you make the transition at this decay, you know for a fact that you were in that level, right? These are things that, well, it's a very particular setup, but there are such things as measurement apparatuses that you can do PVMs on as a good description. Make sense? Yep.
What you just described is a PVM on the...
Yeah. I describe a PVM on the atom. And the atom is measuring the electromagnetic field. You have an atom in the ground state, and you couple it to the electromagnetic field. You want to know if the atom clicked, so if the detector clicked. Then if the atom got excited, but you can check the PVM on the atom. If it's ground or excited, I shine a laser on the atom, and if it goes to a third level, it was excited, and if not, it was ground. It's a very particular setup, but effectively, it's doing a PVM on the atom. Make sense? Because also, after the light, it goes back to the level that it was. Make sense? So you're going to say that there are systems that admit this description for measurements. A limited set of systems, just the measurement apparatus, not everything. Make sense? And then you're done. Philosophically, though, you're not really done because you say, well, but hold on. What are the microscopics of measuring the apparatus? How do you get a PVM in that case? And what one can say is that, well, I can continue measuring, right? I mean, somebody measures the apparatus, and you say, well, but it's not going to be a PVM. It's going to be, in general, something else. I said, sure. But then, you know, you can couple some measurement device to the measurement apparatus to read it out. In this particular case, we're coupling a laser, and we were coupling some screen, an LCD, you know, like a CCD or something that detects the light coming out with the transition ghost. And then you say, you see, we describe everything quantum and the environment. And of course, the LCD, the CCD, the screen, knowing that, well, light arrived at this area, it's a PVM, light is here, the state is that, and then that updates the atom, and in turn that updates the system, right? So it's all POVM, except for the screen. It's at the level of the screen that we do the PVM. And people say, okay, fine, but then how do you describe the measurement of the screen? See what I mean? There's always a level in which, for Nyman's dilation theorem, that you have to say, well, here I'm able to do PVMs. Make sense? That is what we call the Heisenberg cut. The Heisenberg cut arrives at the level that, well, at some point I'm going to say that there are a set of systems that I can get classical outcomes and update with a PVM. Make sense, everybody? Now, this is a big problem. Who measures the measurer? We're not going to care about this problem much. But just so you know that it is, you need to stop at some point, right? You need to set a level. And if you go to philosophy, you find all sorts of opinions and everything else. Because in the end, you know, we detect things. I mean, all the way from it happens as a process in our minds to it happens at a level, so it doesn't ever happen. So we have an incomplete description as of now of how it works. Keep in mind that in the end, it's going to be you who measures. By you mean a person, right? Or, you know, in the end, if we talk about it, you can say, no, a computer does it. It's all automatic. Yeah, no, but we talk about it, right? At some point, one of us is writing down either in our minds or somewhere a number out of the probability distribution. So the whole chain does imply us. Will the Heisenberg cut happen before us? Definitely should, in my opinion, but up for discussion. Does that make sense? Are we familiar with the issues about the measurement problem here? So that's why the measurement problem is still an open problem. We don't have a complete description of the microscopics of a measurement. We have very nice operational solutions. Again, Neimar's theorem tells you, like, you can't forget. The moment you have a detector that you say, no, sir, look, man, this is a 3, and that's it, then you're done. Because you describe the detector as, I measure this with PVMs, and that's done. Operationally. But interpretationally, you still have the issue that what is the microscopics of measuring a detector? But the first problem that we had, that detectors were outside of quantum mechanics, is solved. So Neimar's dilation theorem solves partially the issue. That's what I meant when I said that. Questions about any of this? Does that all make sense? Quantum mechanics is weird in that sense. Not weird in the sense that popular science says it is, but weird in the sense that there are some parts of it that are difficult to explain microscopically. Like, again, the measurement problem. Make sense? All right. Now, things get more interesting and a bit worse. And when I mean a bit, I mean a lot worse. If we want to consider relativity in here. So let me show you something, just so you know about the problem. Oops. That's not what I want. So the issue here now, right? In mind that we want to do quantum information fully relativistically. We want to put, so this is very common when, and it reminds me of an anecdote here at Perimeter in the first It from Qubit conference that was. There were people talking about, it was related to holography, and people talking about putting information on space-time. Somebody drew a qubit like that and a qubit there, and then I remember Faye Dauker. Faye Dauker is great. I hope I have the paper here, Faye Dauker. Faye Dauker asked, sorry, what do you mean with putting a qubit in that region of space-time? And then the person said, yeah, putting it here. I don't know, you can't do that. And the person, what do you mean I can't do that? Of course I can put a qubit there, no? So this is related to issues with localization, the locality of the theory. All right. There's a little bit of fun, I guess. It's funny, with this, I go there in 2015. I don't have anything against Devin Powell. It's just a poor example. It's like an example, right, of people doing popular science when they try to describe entanglement, right? And this is actually nice. It's a real website called Popular Science. Very nice to have again to act as an example of popular science. Look at this. The race to prove spooky quantum connection may have a winner. Entanglement breakthrough could lead to unhackable internet. Jesus Christ. Particles don't obey the same rules as people. It's very nice of him to tell us, right? Poke a particle and another one far away can instantly respond to touch without any messages passing through the space between, as if the two particles were one. Entanglement is what quantum physics calls the intimate connection. Maybe I should add that to the notes, right? That's what we call entanglement. Anyway, Einstein called it spooky. To his dying day, he refused to believe that nature could be so unreasonable. No, this is true. You see, the scheme of popular science typically is like, okay, I want a headline, then I want a sub-headline that relates it to, with some buzzwords, to things that people can relate to. So in this case, internet, why not? And then a lot of things that are so sensational that, of course, to be so sensational, you need to get into the blatantly incorrect. And then one little thing that's correct. That is a scheme that has been going on for many years. Huh? If you actually look at the original, in 1932, the EPR paper made the front page of the New York Times. Had a headline after the Solvay conference. And it was very interesting because it was very similar at this. Like, it had a big headline saying that Einstein argues that quantum mechanics is wrong. Something I forget. I honestly forget. But and then it's like a scientist and two colleagues, which is. Einstein was famous by then, by the way. Einstein becomes famous after the eclipse experiment, right? And everybody's like, wow, time's relative, that's kind of cool. And becomes like TV famous in a way, or newspaper famous. Everybody knows Einstein. So it was Einstein and two colleagues, which is, I guess, the person that, that erased the blackboards after him and the person that gave him coffee. That's the impression that they gave. Anyway, they don't mention the name of the other two people. Einstein and two colleagues. Argue that the spooky behaves spooky and very similar to that, and at the end they argue that quantum mechanics may be correct but not complete. Oh, there you go, an element of reality. So we've been doing this for a long time, and this is the scheme of popular science, and something that has to change. Anyway, this is what I told you, right? You get the classical correlations, right? And the difference with entanglement versus the classical correlations is that now the two subsystems are individually producing random outcomes, but the two random outcomes are correlated, right? So if I throw the die here, I get an outcome, and the moment I see my outcome, I know what the role of the other person is going to be. And that's what inspires people to say, well, you know, if you measure here, maybe you destroy the randomness here. Has to be some sort of action at a distance and some collapse model of some kind. And sure, it doesn't violate relativity, they would tell you, because the information cannot travel faster than light. If Alice finds out, it needs time for the information to propagate, right? That's the classic way of describing this. Now, the problem with this kind of interpretations and collapse models is that it's very difficult. So when you say something like that, it's very difficult to actually have a model that is consistent with relativity and also collapse model, right? Because this statement in itself, right? Here's that we have. No, we have two events, A and C, and three observers. The observers are all at B, at the point B in space-time. The difference between them is, of course, that they have different relative speeds, right, when the experiment happens. So, of course, who measures first, right? If you have Alice and Charlie having an entangled pair, depends on who you ask. So this notion of Alice measures and collapses the system of C makes no sense in absolute terms, because there are observers that are valid observers that would definitely see Alice collapsing first, and other observers that would see Charles collapsing first. Makes sense? And some of them, of course, would also see them doing at the same time, and then who collapses what? Makes sense? So it's very difficult to make sense, even though, of course, people work on collapse models. It's very difficult to make a statement saying, oh, Alice has collapsed when C measured, because there's no causal relationship between things that are space-like separated. So this notion of poking at a distance is very incompatible with how I see the world. Make sense? So it's not enough to say, oh, but the information takes a while to get there, so it's safe. Sure, it is safe, but if you want to explain the microscopics, then this model cannot be compatible with relativity like this. Make sense, everybody? So, yeah, instantaneous action is incompatible with relativity. You already knew that. And you think, well, but you're safe if the information that... Sure, you're safe operationally, but the microscopics then. How do you argue? You cannot say that somebody collapsed something. for the other person if the two are space like separated. Make sense? Now, of course, to do things right, working with quantum mechanics and putting relativity on top is not the way to do it. That is doomed to fail. Makes sense? If you do quantum mechanics, well, I mean, there are many people who do it, and they're really good, and they may disagree with me saying doomed to fail, but to me, that's not the right way of doing things. Like, if I have quantum mechanics, and on top of that, I impose relativistic constraints, then there's some definition, like, what is my relativistic constraint? Oh, I cannot communicate faster than light. Okay, sure, but then how do you explain the collapse models like that? For me, you need a theory where, by construction, axiomatically, is relativistic already. So we're going to visit the measurement problem again. In particular, we're going to just summarize the measurement problem, the classic measurement problem, and then talk a little bit about it in the context of relativistic quantum mechanics, and in particular, in QFT. Okay. So let me give you a little bit of statements, and then you tell me if you disagree, yeah, or you find it reasonable. So at least some measurements can give values, definite values, that we can write on a notepad. Is that statement reasonable? I think so. Not all of them will, but some of them will, at least. In quantum mechanics, we model that with idealized measurements, right? And idealized measurements are, if just to make it simple, non-degenerate observable state updates, you just apply a rank one projector. That's how you update the state after a measurement that gives you a definite value. Make sense? And the problems that we have, the important bit is that, well, as an effective description, it works. Make sense? You can just shut up and compute, use it to model your experiments, and you're fine. The rich are not sure, but famous, yeah. Now, again, I emphasize that it's an open problem, right? But then what happens in QFT? I'm going to summarize a bit. Maybe I'll tell you more than the presentation says, because it's a shorter presentation that I usually give about this. There's a lot of interesting papers to build up to that. So imagine you want to measure localized observables of a quantum field, right? You know, the nice thing, everybody familiar with QFT here, at least basic level? QFT is a quantum theory that for which we have extra set of axioms, right? And the extra set of axioms are aimed towards the fact that we want to build a local theory, and in particular, relativistic local theory. We impose a set of axioms that imposes the locality, in quantum mechanics, the notion of locality that relativity has, right? People tried first to do something called relativistic quantum mechanics, failed dramatically, as you probably know. Like Dirac tried, Klein and Gordon, all these people, and it was actually maybe a paper that I'll discuss by Malamin that put the final nail on it, and then in the end we say, well, we need to axiomatize from the beginning, not do relativistic quantum mechanics, but from the beginning build a theory that's relativistic from scratch instead of imposing relativistic things on it. Make sense? We need to stop thinking about particles, perhaps. That's the issue. That's the main issue. Anyway. But again, I can actually give you a problem that has a definite answer. I have a machine that measures the electric field in this room, right? And that's a quantum field, electric field amplitude. And it gives me 42 volts per meter, right? Or something like that. Yeah, 42 volts per meter, which is a realistic value, more or less, same order of magnitude as it should be. So what do you do now after you measure the electric field in this room? How do I update the state in this case? Make sense? You do have a definite value. Can you just use idealized measurements? Can I do a projector on the field? That's the question. Would that work as an effective description? So Raphael Sorkin in 1992 was the first person to say that it doesn't. In the end, I'm not going to talk much about the sum over histories approach, but the idea here is that they discuss, let me just get the sentence here. It is argued that this problem leaves the Hilbert space formulation of quantum field theory with not definite measurement theory, removing whatever advantage it may have seemed to possess to other ways of doing things. Let me explain this paper a little bit. He does two things in the paper. First, he works with a toy model. And the toy model is, this is not QFT, obviously, it's a toy model that says, well, consider a state 0A. Perform a local unitary on A, okay? I do a unitary that is local to A. And make an idealized Bell measurement, so I'm projecting over this Bell state, meaning that I do a non-local measurement, right? A Bell measurement, and I obtain that the value is this one. This corresponds to this state. Now, you project, of course, the update rule. If you made that, you need to project the system on that state. Agreed? And what he proves is that the expectation of an observable on B gives information about the unitary on A. Even though the unitary was local and before the measurement, B cannot have any information about A, after the measurement it can. Make sense? Is that understood? The claim understood? Now, if you ask, it's like, well, are you surprised about that? Probably the answer should be no, because you're violating locality with this measurement. Agreed? This measurement is not local. You're acting on both systems at the same time. So unsurprisingly, through the act of measuring, B now gets information about what happened on A. Make sense? And then Rafael moves to a quantum field theory example. So consider a state of the field rho, then perform a local unitary on a region of the field here. This red area is the region of the field where you perform a localized unitary on the field, so only in your lab, okay? Then make an idealized measurement on spacetime. Is making an idealized measurement on a full horizontal slice of spacetime here. I'm projecting over a measurement of the field. And he shows that now expectation of local observables of another area that is space-like separated from A has information now about what you did on A. Make sense? Everybody? Is that understood? Yeah?
What do you mean by the horizontal slice projection?
The projective measurement support. So this is a projector that has support everywhere in space-time. Well, in space, in that slice. Make sense? Now, I haven't discussed. Let me quickly see if I have it here. Because maybe this version is too simple for you. No, I do have everything. Okay, well, not everything. Everything that I want to show you. Okay. So then you may argue, well, why in the whole of maybe can you do a smaller localized projective measurement? We will discuss that. But there's an issue, right? If you make a projective measurement that has support over a full slice of spacetime, perhaps unsurprisingly, this projective measurement is putting B in touch with A, even though they're space-like separated. Make sense? So there's a problem that Sorkin pointed out, and people in my field of research, this happened in 2015, right? 1999. And I was doing my PhD in 2011, 10-11, right? And people kept, I was working in this field, and there were things that people were doing that very much assume that we have idealized measurements of quantum fields, meaning like we can do this thing, we can measure a mode of a quantum field. We can say, oh, it's 9, the amplitude of the field here, right? I mean, it's not unreasonable. I have to say, it's not an unreasonable assumption. We do those experiments with quantum fields all the time, right? And the problem is that, well, because people kept using it, Faye Dauker wrote a fantastic note. This is the note that made me start working into the measurement problem in QFT myself and how to deal with it. I love it. Relativistic quantum information is the field. So with that title, you see it on archive. It's just an archive. It's a note, huh? It's a note. Useless qubits in relativistic quantum information. Of course, everybody in RQI saw that and read it. And I was like, after reading it, she says, I draw attention to previous work that shows that the observables corresponding to relativistic quantum field modes commonly employed in papers on relativistic quantum information, that comes from quantum optics, huh? That people employ that, cannot be measured by ideal measurements. And then the paper is just maybe one page or something like that explaining a little bit the Sorkin paper and say, please read the Sorkin paper. I had no idea about the Sorkin paper until Faye wrote that. Make sense? Just an eye opener. And I was like, well, holy crap. Yeah, I mean, she's right. We cannot do these things. So what are we doing, really? So people in RQI after that paper, again, paper is interesting, huh? Because it's a note. It's not that the note contains new material. The note is just, can you read Sorkin, please? You're doing things that are not right. And now you probably understand what when Faye said, what do you mean placing a qubit there? What she was meaning. Anyway, people follow two paths, right? The one that I followed is that path. Let's try to model the measurement microscopically, okay? And we'll talk about and use something called particle detectors. There's another path. I also work on things like that, but people work on, okay, how about doing localized, idealized measurements? Is that okay? You know, the problem with Sorkin, remember, the problem with Sorkin was that this P acts on a full slice of spacetime, right? If the P was localized in the causal future of A somehow, then it would not affect B. Make sense? So maybe we can do that. Can we solve this by disallowing two non-local kinds of measurements? Make sense? Yeah, question.
If you increase the height of P there so that you allow more time to occur,
yeah,
you can move B into the temporal space as opposed to the spatial space.
Yeah, but that is the same as I. That's literally the implementation of not two non-local kinds of measurements.
Right, but you can kind of force locality by saying, I'll just allow more time for my measurement.
And this is literally what was so. What I'm telling you is this is it. This is what you do. You say, oh, the vector measurement takes a while, so maybe do a square, and it's localized, and it's not a fine thing. It's just a tall thing, it's square, and so on. Or a diamond, to be more precise.
So why don't we include time in any of our discussions?
That's a good point. So you see, you can have that the projective measurement lasts on time, as you were saying. So it's that's literally what people was doing, yeah? Including myself and others. Make sense? So would that work? Well, so if you just naively look at Sorkin's paper, you may think, yeah, because the problem is the localization, right, of P. And here's a more recent paper, 2019. In this case, they actually prove that even if you have localized projective measurements as thick as you want or whatever you want, you can always do a second measurement that puts in contact the light cone of two of them. By that meaning that, no, you cannot really solve the problem by localizing the measurements. You just need to include a third one that gets both in touch. The moment that you have fat ones, that won't solve it. I'm summarizing a lot. This paper is great, by the way. It's the paper also identifies the sets of POVMs that, or the infinitely huge, super huge set of POVMs that are okay with doing respecting the causal structure of the field. And in particular, idealized ones will not, and many others. Huh? That's a very interesting paper. Well, this is also related to this, right? There's this paper by Michael Redhead in 1994, which says, in this paper, questions about vacuum, well, these are really great abstract. Vacuum fluctuations in local measurements and the correlations between such fluctuations are discussed. It is shown that maximal correlations always exist between suitably chosen local projection operators associated with space-dissipated regions. This is kind of cool. It's a discussion that, no, you do have correlations between space-dissipated regions of space-time. You have entanglement in suitable states of the field. And by suitable, I mean, for example, the vacuum state of the field. There's entanglement between space-dissipated regions. But the interesting thing about here, okay, what do particle detectors detect? The question of what do particle detectors detect is addressed. And there is a particular theorem that is very nice in that paper that says that if P is an element of the, this is the, RO is the local algebra of observables, the local algebras of self-adjoint operators that are of the field that are localized in region O, okay? So if P is in the local algebra of observables, if P in particular is a projector that is localized in space-time, then it is an infinite dimensional projector. The proof is actually easy, of course, if you don't want to prove the theorem that he uses. The proof is like, well, the result of Drissler, if you believe it, or if you accept it as faith, the quasi-local algebra associated with that unbounded wedge of space-time is a type 3 factor. So basically saying, if I divide space-time into wedges, all the elements of the algebra in this wedge have to be a von Neumann type 3 factor. And then you say, well, if you have any bounded region, something localized, right? It has to be internal to a wedge. By one of the axioms of quantum field theory, this isotony, meaning that if I have a local algebra of a big region, the subalgebras of a smaller region are contained in the algebra of the big region. That's a summary of the isotony axiom, right? Then it's a subalgebra of some of the wedge algebras. So the projectors in RO have to be identified with some of the projectors in the wedge, but the projectors in the wedge is a type 3 factor. All the projectors in the wedge are infinite dimensional. So all the projectors in RO have to be infinite dimensional. Very nice. But what does that mean? That means that a projector that acts localized in spacetime cannot be a rank 1 projector. Cannot be just telling you your value was 42. Make sense? Is that I don't care much about the math here. I care about the result. You cannot have a rank 1 projector that is doing localized, implementing localized measurements in a quantum field. That makes sense? Yeah. So the way we solve this, maybe I would not get much into this, but there are several people working on this. You see the issue, right? The issue is that you cannot really, even ideally, even as a tool to work with projective measurements in QFT. If you are in a regime that you can do a projective measurement, you're not relativistic, you're not covariant, you're not gonna be able to describe any relativistic effect because the act of measuring is screwing up the causal structure. Make sense? You cannot do idealized measurements, no matter what, in a QFT. So there are different ways. I mean, I can tell you about, yeah, question.
That's very good, right? Because it kind of begs for like, to reconcile gravity quantum.
Oh, I fully agree with you. Like, this is inspiring in the sense that maybe begs in the sense that you hope that when you do a theory that is complete in that sense, would solve this automatically.
Plus, it's also very good because, like, because QFT is what? Like, QFT is like quantum and special relativity together.
No, and general relativity.
I mean, but like at very high scale, QFT breaks down, right? Because like
you would expect?
QFT requires spacetime background to be defined on.
To be what, sorry?
Background, like spacetime to be defined on.
No, but you can do it dynamically. Of course, it's very difficult, but you can do quantum field theory in curved spacetimes. That's not an issue. I mean, it is an issue in terms that it becomes difficult and things become super interesting. But you can do it dynamically. You can solve.
Yeah, but curved spacetime, it's like fixing a background.
Then you can do approximations, as in like semi-classical gravity, or you can do stochastic gravity, you know? People can do things. And I agree, that will eventually give us, if people keep making progress there, it may actually illuminate the path towards doing a proper theory with gravity is also quantum. I agree. Sure, but having gravity classical and the rest of things quantum, you can build effective theories for that are dynamical. Like, for example, something called passive quantum gravity. Passive quantum gravity, you say, semi-classical gravity, you just put expectation value bars on the stress energy density in Einstein equations. The next step, if you want, is called passive quantum gravity, which is solve Einstein equations as if T mu nu was classical. It's not, it's gonna have hats. But once you have the solutions, put hats and expectation values at the end, meaning that you're gonna have now variances of gravity and induced fluctuations of gravity, which is classical, coming from quantum. But I agree, understanding these problems, in my opinion, is actually maybe fundamental to actually solve the finding a good theory of quantum gravity. Something happened in the, so no, this thing was big. There are two waves, if you want, of AQFT, axiomatic formulations of quantum field theory. One of them, so people like Weidman and, well, many people, I don't know. And there's a disconnect. In the 70s, 80s, people stopped going to do research on AQFT that much, only very few, because something happens that's called string theory that's very promising, and people say, why study QFT more if that's not the solution is gonna be do this other thing? String theory arguably has not delivered the promise, and now people are coming back to many things, including AQFT. So now we have a new generation of AQFT people. Anyway, let me just tell you a couple of things of how we deal with that, how we do measurements. So in relativistic quantum, regardless whether you care about quantum gravity or not, you need to work. If you want to do relativistic quantum information, you should be able to model measurements. I'll tell you, there are many people, very good, all of them, that work on ways to solve that. I'll tell you about two of them because it's time constraints, right? I'll tell you about the ones that I do, which makes sense that I tell you, I guess, and the other one that Chris Fuster and people that work with him do. So the idea here is defining a set, I'll be very fast, defining a set of things. I want to axiomatize measurements, right? And I define a set of characteristics that that you want measurements to satisfy, right? And those are some reasonable ones that I can talk about. So the Chris Fuster, for example, uses QFT, in which you distinguish between a quantum field that is a target and a quantum field that is a probe. And the coupling between the target and the probe is localized in space-time. This is a fully relativistic theory, so there's no issues whatsoever with causality. The challenge with that is, okay, how do you measure the probe field? Still a field. So how do you actually extract information from that probe field, right? So that's one approach of doing measurements. The one that we use is we can couple a system to the field, same as what you do in reality, in a way. We couple an atom, for example, to the quantum field to measure it. And the atom effectively admits a non-relativistic internal description, quantum mechanical non-relativistic. For a hydrogen atom, it is okay to use non-relativistic internal mechanics for it. Everything else would be, let me put it like that, the center of mass, degrees of freedom are all fully relativistic, but the internal levels are described by just quantum mechanics. You can couple those to the field for finite amounts of time and finite amounts of space. And that's called the particle detector approach. We use the nice thing is that those particle detectors are non-relativistic internally, meaning that I can do PVMs on them, and it's fine, and it works. Now, you can wonder, does that screw up relativity? Well, the discussion is that you can actually prove that. If you're careful with these models, it doesn't. The whole point is that, well, the system is internally non-relativistic, so of course it's at risk of introducing some non-relativistic effects, right, that are going to screw up things. Well, if you're careful, no. You can have a full covariant model and no signaling model, or at least within reasons. I'm not going to talk about much. This is something that Jose, PhD student of mine, Luis Garay, a professor in Spain, and myself developed in this paper, where we actually talk about the measurement theory that you get out of that. So Nymark's dilation theorem, you couple a detector, you measure the detector. Now the update is a POVM on the field. And we show that that POVM is causal, and it doesn't have the Sorkin problem, and so on and so forth. You should read on both. There's a paper, maybe I'll tell you later, there's a paper that does a summary of these two approaches, actually, that was written by Doreen Fraser and Maria Papagiorgiou, where they look at the different, the two different, look at the problem in general, and in particular, they looked at the Fuster, Chris Fuster approach and our approach. They're very similar, and we're working into making touch, right, in a way. Like, you see, in the end, how do you measure the probe field? For example, we have results that show how you get the particle detector emerging out of a fully relativistic theory when you localize it and connecting things with what Fuster does. But I don't want to spend much more time on that. I think that for today, that's fine. But the idea, I hope that is clear, that measuring things in QFT, it's a bit more complicated, but a bit, I mean a lot, fundamentally more complicated than the measurement problem itself, as I explained. And I think, given PSI, it's good that you hear these things, right? Anyway, questions we have time for, I think. A couple questions, if you have them. You know about the fact that you cannot really do relativistic quantum mechanics? Have you heard what's the problem with relativistic quantum mechanics? You know what that is, right? Relativistic quantum mechanics is...
I think it was like QED had like divergences, right?
Oh, no, that's not relativistic quantum mechanics. That's QFT. And just QED, not QED. The perturbative approach to QED is played with divergences. In fact, we know that the perturbative sum in QED is divergent. It's not like maybe divergent. No, no, it is divergent. It doesn't converge to anything. And it's a cool thing, actually, because you know that at order 4, we get the most precise prediction ever in physics, still to date, which is the gyromagnetic constant of the electron, predicted with 14 digits of accuracy by the theory, by summing two terms of a series that we know is divergent, meaning that if you go, oh, I want to be more precise, I want to go order 10, then you get orders of magnitude off because the freaking series is divergent. But order 4 nails it. Do you know that? Ah, it's cool. It's a different kind. I could explain why we think that happens, but that will take a while. But it's a fun thing. So that is a QFT, and the problem of perturbation theory, right? Whether the perturbative series is convergent or not. Yeah.
So like okay. So like higher order calculations lower the Landau bowl.
Yeah, kind of.
Okay.
It's not. It's more like the perturbative series is not the whole story. So when you have, if I were to write, so imagine that your result is this, right? I don't know. Goes like that, where this is the coupling, this is the coupling strength, right?
This is
a full result. Imagine the actual result were like that.
Yeah.
You cannot tailor expand that.
And
the problem that we have is something like this. We are getting the actual solution. We can do it. We can get a system that we know how to solve non-perturbatively. For example, an harmonic perturbation to a harmonic oscillator. That I can solve non-perturbatively and also use perturbation theory. And then you prove that the solution has some of that. And this thing starts kicking in at values of the coupling strength that are comparable to the order of the perturbation. So. Literally, this term is not captured by a Taylor expansion. That's what's happening. And that's why this term, in the end, will make things converge. And that's why the series is divergent. And that's why some more, until this term kicks in, you're going to be fine with some orders. But higher orders will not. That's what actually happens. Anyway, point being that this is cool. But this is QFT, so not this course. I think the important thing for this course is the notion of what are the containers of information. Think in particle physics like. In particle physics, if you see a lot of particle physics, you may be tempted to think in terms of particles, meaning like, oh, there are photons, there are electrons, there are Higgs bosons, and think of them very classically, right? A very classic lesson, like, oh, a particle is a local, what is a particle? Well, a particle, classically, is something that is somewhat localized, no? And the momentum of it is somewhat localized as well. That's a particle, no? More or less, you think of it as living somewhere. Now, you know already that things like photons, quote unquote, that have you see, another thing that you get a response when you ask people, what is the difference between quantum and classical? And people tell you, well, in quantum, things come in packets of energy, right? Well, that's so not true. That's neither sufficient nor necessary for a quantum theory, right? Again, you can have a Dirichlet cavity, a cavity with Dirichlet boundary conditions, right? Classical field inside, cancels at the boundaries. And indeed, the energy levels are quantized for that. And that's not quantum. You can also have a free electron, right? And a free electron can have any energy, a continuum of energy, continuous spectrum, right? And that is quantum. So things coming in packets of energy is neither necessary or sufficient to be quantum. You also know that if you call that this is a photon of energy, h bar omega, well, that thing is extremely delocalized. That thing lives everywhere in the universe at all times. So it's certainly not something that fits in your lab. If you say that in your lab you have h bar omega, a photon is wrong. Maybe a good approximation to the level that you work, but it's definitely wrong. That thing lives everywhere. It doesn't fit in a lab. Now, the problem with particle physics is the problem with relativistic quantum mechanics is that it had the prejudice of thinking about particles, which is a very classical non-relativistic and quantum prejudice. There is, maybe I should show you this abstract, and we leave it at that, because it's fantastic. It's like a genius abstract by Nobel Prize winner. Let me just find it. It's an abstract that I love reading together with people. No, that's not right. That will be for later. Anyway, I'll just Google it. Anti-photon. Lamb. Okay, let's go slowly. I'm gonna just uncover it slowly. So the title is Antiphoton. And it says, it should be apparent from the title of this article that this is by the way, Willis Lamb, Nobel Prize winner, one of the founding fathers of quantum optics. A person who knew, you know, when quantum optics was invented by people who knew QFT. As well as, you know, make a series of approximations on QFT in order to get something simpler, and that's quantum optics. So again, he won the Nobel Prize. This was written in 1995. This is the kind of abstract that you can write if you won a Nobel Prize. It's great. It should be apparent from the title, this article, that the author does not like the use of the word photon, which dates from 1926. In his view, there is no such thing as a photon. Oof. Only a comedy of errors and historical accidents led to its popularity among physicists and optical scientists. I admit the word is short and convenient, and its use is also habit-forming. Similarly, one might find it convenient to speak of the ether or vacuum to stand for empty space, even if no such thing existed. There are very good substitute words for photons, e.g. radiation or light, and for photonics, e.g. optics, or even better, quantum optics. Similar objections are possible to the use of the word phonon, which is 1932. Okay, here's the key. Well, there are two things that are cool about this abstract. The fact that it characterizes the use of the word photon as a result of a comedy of errors, which is kind of interesting. Now, this is key. Objects like electron, neutrinos of finite rest mass, or helium atoms can, under suitable conditions, be considered to be particles, since their theories have viable, non-relativistic, and non-quantum limits. And this is the key sentence. I mean, the paper doesn't even talk about this, but this is the key sentence. The key sentence is that you cannot have something that is relativistic and quantum at the same time and talk about it in terms of particles. There is a wonderful paper, see if I can find it, in Defense of Dogma. No. Malament. Yes. Oh, you don't have access. Anyway, whatever. So you can tell. David Malament wrote this paper that you need to apparently buy here to read it. So, in Defense of Dogma, why there cannot be a relativistic quantum mechanics of localizable particles. This is a very interesting paper. This is a philosopher of physics. The paper is math, so it's proofs, a theorem proof paper, a beautiful one. Why is it called In Defense of Dogma? So when a philosopher, so Weidman, who was one of the founding fathers of QFT, well, axiomatic formulation of QFT, was discussing that, particles cannot exist. People are talking, philosophers of physics and high energy physicists keep talking about particles all the time. And one man said, I don't think particles are well defined. And in the AQFT community, people talk about all the time, I don't think particles are a well-defined thing. I give you arguments like the ones I'm giving you, right? Like, no, you cannot really have relativistic and quantum systems be localized enough to be called particles and things like that. And people, there are many arguments to give. And some brand of philosophers of physics, they called it the no-particle dogma. And it was called a dogma because there was no proof that that is a reasonable statement. There's, you know, people arguing about it. So it was called a dogma that people believed within AQFT. And philosophers were telling us, same as today, they would tell us, some philosophers would tell us, and very rightly so, but come on, most physicists, you're telling me that rigorously there's no notion of particle, but most physicists talk in terms of particles, at particle colliders, you know, particle physics. There must be something. We need to care about that in philosophy, right? That's why the paper is called In Defense of Dogma. In Defense of Dogma, why there cannot be a relativistic quantum mechanics of localizable particles. In many of the papers, when people talked about the impossibility of doing that, giving arguments, there were references saying, Weidman, personal communication. And that carried enough authority in the field to know if Weidman says it, he's right. We don't know yet why, but he's right. And that's why it deserved the name of dogma a little bit, because there was a lot of references of private communication. Well, this paper proves that there are three assumptions that are not compatible. Not going to be accurate here, but the assumptions are a description that is relativistic, an interpretation of the wave function at some probability distribution of finding a particle somewhere, the idea of particle, and localization. You cannot have the three. That is why when you try to do relativistic quantum mechanics theories, like for example, you know the thing about Klein and Gordon and Dirac, trying to, you know, Klein Gordon presents a relativistic version of Schrödinger equation. You know, Schrödinger was the first one to try to write a relativistic Schrödinger equation, but then he saw a square root in the Hamiltonian with, well, I need to know, matrices, I was thinking, oh, no, no. Let me just write the non-relativistic version. So Klein-Gordon said, okay, let's consider, we still have issues with the square root, but why don't we take the square, right? That's what Klein-Gordon did. Hamiltonian, free particles, and take the square, Klein-Gordon equation. Then you try to predict what happens with the wave function, if you call it a wave function, and so on. And then finds that, you know, there are things that are weird, you know, like sometimes you get interpretation of negative probabilities or things like that. And then Dirac comes and said, well, the problem is that your equation is second order because of the square that you took, right? You need a first order equation. And Klein-Gordon said, yeah, I've tried, we've tried. I mean, there's no such thing. Are you sure? Paraphrasing, of course, this didn't happen like this, but are you sure? And then Klein-Gordon said, well, yeah, I mean, we're Klein-Gordon, we are sure, there's nothing there. Can I try anyways? Yeah, please be my guest. So Dirac tries and finds that there's none. And then Dirac says, well, if I keep increasing the algebraic nature of the objects that are in the equation, maybe I can do it. And he finds like 4x4 matrices, right? Dirac equation with the gamma matrices and can describe it. Dirac equation doesn't have any very successful thing, doesn't have things that can be interpreted as negative probability densities, nice. Predicts antiparticles, which is nice. It has like, you know, spin emerges out of it because we know spin is relativistic, not quantum. You have a four-dimensional spinner now. And you say two of those components are corresponding to spin that emerges out of the electron description. The other two structure comes from like there has to be something like electron, but it's CP inverse of it, so it's positron prediction. 2 years later, people find positrons, very cool. 2 years later, Klein finds something called the Klein paradox, which is a problem of Dirac equation, which is if I send an electron against a potential wall that is more than twice the mass of the electron, I get something really weird. The wave function gets like, it gets with probability one, or no one, but let's say probability one reflected, but also probability one transmitted. What? So you get more than one summing up. Meaning that, no, there's no interpretation as a probability density for the wave function because there's no freaking notion of particles. It's inconsistent mathematically. QFT would explain it like, yeah, the potential creates a pair electron positron. The positron is accelerated through the electron is reflected, so you get probability one. It just makes no sense. I mean, you can think of it that in those terms, but the thing is that you cannot really have relativistic quantum mechanics, and that proves it, yeah.
Maybe not relativistic quantum mechanics, but like, I'm confused about the ordering particles because in QFT1 we built quantum field theory like this. So we take like creation and annihilation operators, we impose like class decomposition principle, then locality, like space like correlation, and then what we find is that like field theory is not necessary, but like it's like a convenient description of relativistic quantum mechanics, and I see that like
is the description of if you want to do relativistic quantum mechanics in a relativistic framework, QFT is the only way.
Or most convenient.
I would say the only. I think that if you find another, it's gonna be QFT. One to one. And again, what I'm saying here is where are the particles? In the QFT that you did with Weinberg, where are the particles? What would you call the particles there? We have fields, not particles. What?
Operator,
oh, but what? Like in a mode expansion in frequencies, those things are infinitely delocalized. So that's why you have the parentheses there. Those things that you create with a dagger on the vacuum are delocalized, and you can say, well, I can make a wave packet. Okay, maybe you can make a wave packet, right? So you can have an f of k, a dagger, but you know what happens with a wave packet? It's not a Fourier transform to get the spatial distribution. You get extra factors, like you have the square root of the modulus k in that integral over frequencies. And that tells you that the spatial distribution is not going to be, if your field is massive, you can do it. For a massive field, I can do it. I get infinite tails, I need infinite tails still, but you know, the tails can be exponentially suppressed. With massless field, you can't. For a massless field, you cannot have infinitely exponentially suppressed tails. You have very delocalized, at the very least, wave packets. And then why call that particles? Instead, you say, well, I have excitations of the field that come from interactions. And you know, there's what I have in the lab is not that. That's what I mean. Nothing that has tails that gets out of the lab is describing what you have in the lab. You have, the solution is that any state that is localizable, in terms of those particles that you're telling me, will have an infinite number of them. It's a sum over many Fock states, not just the one that you create with a dagger. Is it a good approximation to consider? Yeah, sure, but this is important to distinguish an approximation that works from a fundamental description. So no state of that kind would fit in your lab. In order to fit in your lab, you're going to have infinite components of. And again, this is theorem. Huh? That tells you that this characteristics that you want from it are impossible. You cannot do it. Anyway, cool. I'm not saying particle physics is wrong at all. What I mean is that as a fundamental notion, particles leave things to be desired, right? And that is very related with in relativistic quantum information. In particle physics, most people care about this S matrix. And it doesn't matter because infinite time, I don't care about the delocalization because they live forever, the things, you know? I have some free theory and interacting theory in between, which is, by the way, not what happens because an electron is always feeling the electromagnetic field, even in the infinite past. They know that, obviously. But the S-matrix approach, it's fine. You don't need to care. But if you want to do relativistic quantum information, which is, I have a lab and lives here, and I'm going to make a measurement that lasts half a second or a nanosecond, and I want to know what's going on. I want to analyze the entanglement structure between this area and this area that are space-like separated. You cannot do S-matrix. And these things start to matter a lot. You go outside of the regimes where the approximation that this is a physical particle, something like, oh, man, OK. This, I told you already, is not a physical. I don't know if you even see anything here, but.
Yeah, it's fine.
OK, this is not a physical particle. That lives everywhere. And you can say, sure, OK, let me create an AF, which is some wave packet, right, of AK dagger, right? I can create that. And then I can add with this AF on the vacuum. And I create something localized. Yeah, that's not a bad description. But depending on what you want to do with it, this thing is going to have tails that are too fat for you to describe it properly. That's my point. Anyway, whatever. Sorry, this is going a little bit long. And you have other lectures to go. But hopefully, we have seen the objective of this lecture was that the measurement problem in quantum mechanics is extremely non-trivial. And the reason why it's extremely non-trivial is related with the fact that localizing things that are quantum and relativistic, it's very tough. Make sense? On Wednesday, we begin quantum circuits and quantum logic and algorithms. So change of flavor completely. But keep this in the back of your mind, because I'm planning that the last lecture would be exclusively discussion. All right? I'm going to ask you to prepare questions, all of you, and things to discuss for the last lecture.